Hello, family.
Hi, George.
Hey, George.
Hi, George.
So I'm going to do this in two parts. I want to talk about where I was, and I want to talk about how I got here and what has occurred since I've been in this program. I want to start with the laundry list. And the laundry list, there's two versions of the laundry list. There's the 14 traits which affect us. And then there's another side of the laundry list on how we affect other people. So I'm going to read those two lists, and I'm going to end with the flip side, which is the good side. So the regular laundry list, we became isolated and afraid of people and authority figures. We became approval seekers and lost our identity in the process. We are frightened by angry people and any personal criticism. We either become alcoholics, marry them or both, or find another compulsive personality, such as a workaholic, to fulfill our sick abandonment needs. We live life with the viewpoint of victims, and we are attracted by the weakness in our love and friendship relationships. We have an overdeveloped sense of responsibility, and it is easier for us to be concerned with others rather than ourselves. This enables us not to look too closely at our own faults. We get guilt feelings when we stand up for ourselves instead of giving in to others. We become addicted to excitement. We confuse love and pity and tend to love people who we can pity and rescue. We have stuffed our feelings from our traumatic childhoods and have lost the ability to feel or express our feelings because it hurts too much. We judge ourselves harshly and have a low sense of self-esteem. We are dependent personalities who are terrified of abandonment and will do anything to hold on to a relationship in order not to experience painful abandonment feelings, which we receive from living with sick people who were never there emotionally for us. Alcoholism is a family disease, and we became para-alcoholics and took on the characteristics of the disease, even though we did not pick up a drink. Para-alcoholics are reactors rather than actors. And the 14 traits of what they call the other laundry list, or the opposite laundry list. To cover our fear of people and our dread of isolation, we tragically become the very authority figures who frighten others and cause them to withdraw. To avoid becoming enmeshed and entangled with other people and losing ourselves in the process, we become rigidly self-sufficient. We disdain the approval of others. We frighten people with our anger and threat of belittling criticism. We dominate others and abandon them before they can abandon us, or we avoid relationships with dependent people altogether. To avoid being hurt, we isolate and disassociate, and thereby abandon ourselves. We live life from the standpoint of a victimizer, and we are attracted to people who can manipulate and control in our important relationships. We are irresponsible and self-centered. Our infatuated sense of self-worth and self-importance prevents us from seeing our deficits and shortcomings. We make others feel guilty when they attempt to assert themselves. We inhibit our fear by staying deadened and numb. We hate people who play the victim and beg to be rescued. We deny that we've been hurt and are suppressing our emotions by the dramatic expressions of pseudo-feelings. To protect ourselves from punishment, self-punishment for failing to save the family, we project our self-hate onto others and punish them instead. We manage the massive amount of what we feel coming from abandonment within the home by quickly letting go of relationships that threaten our independence. We refuse to admit we've been affected by family dysfunction, or that there was dysfunction in the home, or that we were internalized any of the family's destructive attitudes and behaviors. And the last one, we act as if we are nothing like the dependent people who raised us. So I'm going to talk about my 14 traits and how my family life was. I was not raised in an alcoholic family. I was raised in a very dysfunctional family with four rageaholic parents. when I was born, I came into the world, my eyes wide open, and stuck my thumb in my mouth and just gazed around the room at everybody. My mother used Dr. Spock and did not come to me when I cried and left me crying for hours. My mom went from her dad to my dad and had no mothering instincts whatsoever at that point in time. And my earliest memory was when I was before one, how pissed off and angry I was that nobody was taking care of me. The anger was, I turned it around and I just didn't want to be held. I didn't want my mom to hold me. And that anger stuck with me for a long time. When I was 2 and a half, my brother was born, and when they brought him home, my dad was setting up a picture. I was holding my little brother, and I bit him when my dad turned around. And that kind of started the relationship with my brothers. I had, in my first family, there were four of us children with the two parents, and I was such an angry little girl. Oh, I would kick and bite and beat up and manipulate, and I got to the point to where I'd get my favorite possessions. I had this beautiful butterfly mask, and I tore it up, and I told my parents that my brothers had done it, and I learned very early that if I couldn't get attention being good, I was certainly going to do it and get being bad. When I was 5 years old, I remember holding one of my little brother's head to the comfort on the bed and not letting him breathe for a period of time, and I was just a little snothead. Before I was 1 year old, I had crawled 3 times to my dad's medication and had to have my stomach pumped from taking the medication. And my mom said one time she found me and my tongue was blue and she saw my vein just jumping and my fever was 106. And that was the precedence of my life. I have pictures when I was 2 and a half or 3 where my mom would get a towel and tie me to a chair so she could do house cleaning, and it was just for me a fight for attention, and my anger just grew and grew and grew. My mother didn't know how to handle me. The brothers were a lot easier, and I just needed the attention and demanded the attention. My dad traveled a lot, and my mom just didn't know what to do. And the anger, I think when I was probably 6, the spanking started, and I got whipped by the belt probably every day through age 14, maybe. And I think I just got to a point to where I had been spanked too much. And again, the anger just continued to escalate. And my brother had found a bird named Chica. And when my parents were out, I was so jealous of the bird because the bird got all the attention that I wanted. Anything that got attention, I hated. And when my brothers were and family was gone, I got the bird out of the cage and I slammed it against the wall about 4 times until I broke its neck, and part of me broke when I did that. I couldn't believe that I had killed an animal. And I remember times where I'd get my family dog and tie him in the backyard and just get a belt out and whip him. I didn't know what to do. I was really, really, really hurting. When I reached the age of 11, my parents divorced, and my mom said we were going to my grandmother's for 2 weeks, and we ended up moving there. And none of the children knew that the parents were going to be getting a divorce. And whereas I didn't get any love from my mom, and my mom was a rageaholic, so what I haven't told you is there'd be fits where she would just take out her anger on me. I was the kid she took the anger out on, and which is one of the reasons I got whipped every day with the belt. When we went to South Carolina, I was lost, and I wanted my dad, and I was angry with my mother, and my grandfather lived there, and I latched onto my grandfather, and just, he was my hero, and was, I was in a different state from my father, so I didn't get to see him often, and I just, every emotion and everything I had, my grandfather was trying to make up for the love, and he ended up dying within 6 months of us moving there. So my poor brothers, by this time, we'd walk home from school together, and I would just kick and bite and just beat up just endlessly. And my mother started dating a Methodist minister, and they ended up getting married, and I thought, oh, I have a dad now. I've got someone who's close. My father, when my mom allowed him, would come to see us, and as my dad is leaving, I'd have my arms in the window saying, don't leave, Daddy, don't. And he's trying to back the car up, and he's crying, and I'm crying, and it's just... So again, I put my eggs in a basket with a father figure, and when Mom married Calvin, he had three children, one who I saw once, and the other two came along with the marriage. And I soon found out that Calvin was a rageaholic, and the relationship between us was impossibly horrible. And so that was the third father figure that just kind of got lost to the wayside. Calvin, being a Methodist minister, was a very angry man, and so now I had a second parent who was taking his anger out basically on myself. His daughter is mentally retarded and has the mental capability of about a 12-year-old, and she was 15 at the time and started to sexually abuse me, and my family would find me awake on the floor in the living room, and I couldn't figure out what I had done to deserve this, or something I was doing to make her do that. She was a sick individual and ended up getting sent to a mental institution, and I've never seen her since. But that really messed with me, and I found out later that she had sexually abused all three of my brothers, and her brother was messed up from the crap that she did that he caught her doing, and he was always having to take up for her. So it was just, oh my God, the dysfunction was horrible. Methodist ministers move often, and between my dad's divorce and moving and now in a Methodist minister, sometimes we move because of his anger, and sometimes we move because the church just moved us every year. I ended up going to 5 elementary schools and 4 high schools and a kindergarten, so I went to a lot of different schools. I was a complete mess, and we had just relocated to yet another place, and I was maybe 14, and I just thought, I can't do this anymore. And I took a bottle of aspirin thinking that would kill me, and I remember waking up the next morning just crying because I was alive, and I had no way to end the pain. There was just, it was endless. I had never been so unhappy in all my life. Between my mom being angry and my stepfather being angry, And then my dad remarried, and my stepmother, who I kiddingly refer to as the Cuban wench from hell, was another rageaholic. So, and she had three boys, and on the first visit to my stepmother's place, the boys shriek, and all of a sudden you see, she has three sons, you see one run, and then another ran, and then another ran, and here she comes with a coat hanger, and I'm like, oh dear God, what is going on with my parents? So I was telling my counselor not too long ago that I feel very fortunate that, and very blessed to have ended up the adult I am today. There is all the possibility that I could have taken the route and become a psychopath or criminal, and I'm just, first of all, I'm really grateful that I am who I am today. Between that, at 18, I started acting out. When I was a week before turning 20, I discovered sex, drugs, and rock and roll within a week's time. And I think most of the gray hairs on my mother came from that week. I remember the first time I got drunk, I drank 9 beers, and I was sick as a little dog, but my mom lines up my brothers, all the 3 Rice brothers, and lines them up, look at your sister, see what she's done, this is, and I'm like a frog on the bed, and all of a sudden I turn over and throw up, and my mom just, and the boys are, but, oh Lordy. So, next I am discovering drugs. I became a raging drug addict. I took to it really quick. I went from hash to crystal meth, and my stepbrothers were making MDA, so that was really cool and groovy, and I was doing Quaaludes, and then I had a job working for A&M Records, and I discovered coke. And towards the end of my coke usage, I was doing about $1,000 worth of coke a day, and doing 2 Quaaludes every day to try to get an hour's worth of sleep. And my normal weight is 150, and I got down to about 110, and had diarrhea for about 2 or 3 months nonstop. And I lost my house, and I'm thinking, I've got a financial problem. This is ridiculous. So I move in with my mom, and my mom, it has mellowed and is coming to terms with who and what her behavior was, and she's like, I'll allow you to stay if you work and get on your feet. But she came up to me after a week and she said, I'm watching you kill yourself. I'm not going to do that. You either get help or you have to find somewhere else to live. And I'm like, that's fine. So I went out and started looking for a place to live. And by the hand of my HP, whom I choose to call God, God just shut down every single door. And I mean, I looked solid for days. And then all of a sudden I had this bright idea. Oh my God, I heard about this place, the Atlanta Women's Shelter. I can stay there. So I go and I drive up, park my car, the one that hadn't been taken back in by the loan company. And I walk up the stairs, and I'm walking up, and I'm looking, and I open the room, and there must have been 200 or 300 cots in there filled with women and children who had no place to go. And I remember closing the door, not going in, and I thought, I've got a problem. I've got a problem. By this time, I had wrecked 9 cars totaled and walked away. I had been jailed 4 times. I had been on drug deals where I walked into the post office and saw this guy on a most wanted FBI list, and God had allowed me to live. I had been able to go through this, but he had kept me alive, and that in itself is a miracle. Oh, and there was the rape, and there was, I mean, it was just the things that my behavior got me into. So I went into a treatment center, and I got clean, and that was almost 30 years ago. So I learned to become a productive member of society, and I learned to deal with the symptoms of my disease, which at that point was using. And the next few years were hanging on by the seat of my britches. The thing that kept me coming back to meetings was I got involved with people who were service people, service work, and I started going to meetings and making coffee and setting up rooms, and then I start setting up meetings and starting new meetings and going to conventions and talking to newcomers after meetings and sponsoring people and giving back what was so freely given to me. I was just nothing when I came into those rooms, and those people loved me until I could love myself. So I'm clean and I'm living, but every emotion and all that anger I put in a little Pandora's box, and I put it in my body and I shoved it down as far as I could, and I thought, that fucker, and I don't curse, that fucker is never gonna open, never gonna open. And then I met a fellow traveler, and I had gotten to the point to where I had my roof and my ceiling fixed, but the stuff in the basement, that little Pandora's box, was starting to bubble up a little bit. And for me, there was something about that magic age of turning 50 where I thought, I am leaving all the baggage behind and I am stepping forward in a new place with myself. And this fellow traveler I knew for a while before I figured out. I knew it was 12-step, but he was really secretive about it. And finally he said, I think I know what you're missing, because I kept talking to him and I kept going, you know, there's something. And he took me into an ACA meeting, and I tell you what, I heard those 14 traits and I thought, I am home. I am exactly where I need to be. Thank God there are people in this room that are exactly like me. I mean, I can come into this room, I don't have to say a word, and you guys know exactly what I'm talking about. You know exactly what I'm feeling. You know what my day's been like. You know what's been in my head and the hurt and the pain. And I started going to meetings. And I started hanging out with you guys, talking to people, and this little thing called a yellow workbook came into play. And I don't know if you guys can see, but it is dog-eared and written and scratched. I've had this thing 3 years. And I started working the steps. And once I started working the steps, I think on step one, I had my beginning of my true spiritual awakening. You start that step one, and that spirit, that flower, spiritual awakening is like a flower. You start that step one, and that flower starts opening. and you work through those 12 steps, and I guarantee you that flower will open completely. The only time it starts to close is when we turn away from ourselves. So the great thing about this program is it has given me my sanity, and I've been able to dig through the basement. And something that I have done that doesn't necessarily have to, that not all of you do, is I wanted to dig deeper after going through the 12 steps the first time. And I started seeing a therapist because I wanted some help with going through the reason the traits popped up in the first place. And for those of you who haven't worked the steps, it's not about re-traumatizing yourself, and it's not about having to go through and feel everything, but it's walking beside your feelings and acknowledging what happened so you can dig deeper and see where the hurt and the pain comes from, so you can just look at it and acknowledge it and kick its ass out of the way. Because I tell you what, these 14 traits, they kept us alive. They kept us alive. But now with this program, we have steps and we have a way, we've got tools that we can use so we can put the steps aside. The other thing that's been the best thing is reparenting. I can reparent myself. My critical parent is louder than my mom's voice, and that in itself is a miracle. But I have actually visualized myself putting duct tape on my critical parent and setting her in the corner and pulling out the loving parent and listening to my loving parent and allowing the loving parent to come out. And the cool thing is now she's out most of the time and I don't even know it. The other thing that's important when you're in this program, no matter what step, if you're here 2 weeks or 2 years, is listen to people around you. Listen, learn to open your ears and listen with your heart. Listen. A lot of times we want to give advice, but just listen. Being able to be there and just listen. Go into meetings. The thing about going to meetings is that it keeps us, our spirituality intact, it keeps our mental health intact, it keeps ourselves intact, and it gives hope to people who are just coming into the program. The other thing that has been real important to me has been prayer and meditation. Prayer is talking to God. And I'm a preacher's daughter. When I was talking prayer and heard prayer and meditation, I was like, you can just forget about that now because I'm not saying an hour prayer. All you have to do is get up. My prayer is that my eyes, my mouth, my hands, and my feet can be used for God's will. And just whatever short or however long. But the good thing about meditation, we talk to God when we pray. In meditation, we listen to God. And the other thing that has been one of my greatest, greatest, greatest joys is sponsoring. There are a couple ways to sponsor in this program. A lot of us come in and authority figures are scary, and it's easier for us to get a co-sponsor and to have a couple people sponsor each other. The other way is the traditional way, and that's working with someone who is new in the program and helping them go through the steps and helping them to get through day to day. Doing these, going to meetings, and all that I've just said, it has just blessed me. I am so grateful to be here. I am so grateful that I have a family of choice. And I promise you, if you come to meetings and you work the steps and you take it seriously, one day you're going to turn around and you're going to go, whoa! It's okay. I'm doing better. The spiritual awakening will happen. It may not be an orgasmic moment, but it will happen. And all of a sudden, you're going to realize that you've got these tools and you don't have to think about using them, you're just using them. It's a day at a time, a day at a time. And with that, I just want to say thank you for the gifts that I have gotten from ACA, and the biggest one is being able to recover with all of you. And thank you so much. Let me read. I want to read very quickly the flip side of the laundry list. We move out of isolation and are not unrealistically afraid of other people, even authority figures. We do not depend on others to tell us who we are. We are not automatically frightened by angry people and no longer regard personal criticism as a threat. We do not have a compulsive need to recreate abandonment. We stop living life from the standpoint of victims and are not attracted by this trait in our important relationships. We do not use enabling as a way to avoid looking at our own shortcomings. We do not feel guilty when we stand up for ourselves. We avoid emotional intoxication and choose workable relationships instead of constant upset. We are able to distinguish love from pity and do not think rescuing people we pity is an act of love. We come out of denial about our traumatic childhoods and regain the ability to feel and express our emotions. We stop judging and condemning ourselves and discover a sense of self-worth. We grow in independence and are no longer terrified of abandonment. We have interdependent relationships with healthy people, not dependent relationships with people who are emotionally unavailable. The characteristics of alcoholism and para-alcoholism, we have internalized, are identified, acknowledged, and removed. We are actors, not reactors. And the flip side of the other laundry list, we face and resolve our fear of people and our dread of isolation and stop intimidating others with our power and position. We realize the sanctuary we have built to protect the frightened and injured child within has become a prison and become willing to risk moving out of isolation. With our renewed sense of self-worth and self-esteem, we realize it is no longer necessary to protect ourselves by intimidating others with contempt, ridicule, and anger. We accept and comfort the isolated and hurt inner child we have abandoned and disavowed, and thereby end the need to act out our fears of enmeshment and abandonment with other people. Because we are whole and complete, we no longer try to control others through manipulation and force and bind them to us with fear in order to avoid feeling isolated and alone. Through our in-depth inventory, we discover our true identity as capable, worthwhile people. By asking to have our shortcomings removed, we are freed from the burden of inferiority and grandiosity. We support and encourage others in their efforts to be assertive. We uncover, acknowledge, and express our childhood fears and withdraw from emotional intoxication. We have the compassion for anyone who is trapped in the drama triangle and is desperately searching for a way out of insanity. We accept we were traumatized in childhood and lost the ability to feel. Using 12 steps as a program of recovery, we regain the ability to feel and remember and become whole human beings who are happy, joyous, and free. In accepting we were powerless as children to save our family, we are able to release our self-hate and stop punishing ourselves and others for not being enough. By accepting and reuniting with the inner child, we no longer feel threatened by intimacy, by the fear of being engulfed or made invisible. By acknowledging the reality of family dysfunction, we no longer have to act as if nothing was wrong or keep denying that we are still unconsciously reacting to childhood harm and injury. And last, we stop denying and do something about our post-traumatic dependency on substances, people, places, and things to distort and to avoid reality. Thank you, guys.